Revelation chapter 20 is probably the most controversial passage in the book of Revelation. If you know anything about the subject of eschatology, the end times, then you will be aware of the significance of the 20th chapter of the book of Revelation. It is the chapter from which that term millennium comes. Are you pre? Are you post? Are you a? This is a question that divides Christianity. The extent to which it divides Christianity is that it has become a test of orthodoxy. On more than one occasion, I have had that question asked of me when people have visited the church. Where does your church stand on the subject of eschatology? Are you pre? Are you post? Are you a? And depending on the answer to that question, people stay or they go. It amazes me that that is often the first question that gets asked. Not, what's your position on the deity of Jesus Christ? Not, what's your position on the reconciliation that Jesus Christ accomplished on the cross? For whom did he die? And how is salvation achieved? But what do you think is going to happen when Jesus comes again? How do you think the events are going to unfold? And so much of what people argue about, interestingly enough, comes out of this chapter that is before us this morning. And perhaps you have been anticipating this chapter as we've got closer and closer to it and thinking, well, I wonder what he's going to say on this chapter. I must admit that since outlining the series in the book of Revelation, I've looked forward with great anticipation to preaching on this chapter. I hope that that anticipation won't be disappointed this morning. It is interesting that this chapter has generated for itself a significance which is out of proportion with the rest of the book. It really is. The focus that is given to this one chapter is just doesn't fit with the focus that is given to any other part of this book of Revelation. And it all hinges on this term that I have mentioned, this idea of the millennium. And as I've indicated, there are basically three groups that Christians fall into. The premillennials hold to the fact that Jesus Christ will return prior to a period of 1,000 years, which may be either literal or a symbolic period, but nevertheless, he will come before a period in which he will reign physically upon this earth, and then at the end of that time of great progress of the gospel and advance against the kingdom of Satan, Satan will have a brief period in which he will seek to destroy the church, and he himself will ultimately be destroyed. Premillennialists see a continuity between chapters 19 and 20. By that I mean a chronological continuity. In other words, when they read in chapter 20 and verse 1, "Then I saw an angel coming down from heaven," that event of the angel coming down from heaven happens after the previous events that have just been described. And so the rider on the white horse comes, And he comes and he conquers. He wins a great battle. Jesus Christ comes. And then Satan is seized and imprisoned for a period of 1,000 years. Then he's released, and then comes the consummation of all things. It seems to me that among other problems, there's one clear problem within the context of this immediate passage. And that is that in chapter 19, we have a description of the destruction of all men upon the earth who worship the beast. The angel said in verse 17, "Come, gather for the great supper of God to eat the flesh of kings, captains, mighty men, horses and their riders, the flesh of all men, both free and slave, both small and great." And this is what happens. "And the beast and the prophet are cast into the lake of fire, and everyone else is slain by the sword that came from the mouth of Jesus and are consumed by the birds." And then in chapter 20, we're told that Satan is bound so that he might not deceive the nations any longer. The trouble is, there are no nations to be deceived any longer. If we take a chronological continuity, the nations have all been destroyed by Jesus Christ at the end of chapter 19. There are no longer any nations to be deceived by Satan. Postmillennialism holds to the argument that Jesus Christ will reign after this period of 1,000 years that is spoken of in chapter 20. That he will come after a period in which Christianity makes great progress in the world because of Satan being bound. It particularly has in view the idea of Christianity progressing into all aspects of society so that basically the world becomes more and more Christian. Not just that there are more and more Christians in the world, but that the world itself, the planet Earth, is populated by Christians who live Christian lives in peace and comfort without opposition. It's a very positive view of the progress of Christianity in the world affecting all of society. Now, there's a problem with that view as well. There's a problem of consistency with the rest of Revelation, which tells us over and over and over and over again of all the suffering and curse of God upon this world that seems, if anything, to get greater and greater and greater toward the end of time, not less and less and less. And then there's this amillennial view, or amillennial if you're American. And this view is that if you take the word literally, is no millennium. A negates the word that follows. A millennial, no millennia, no 1,000 years. The problem with this view is mainly a problem with labelling. It is hard, I would say it's impossible, to ignore the reality of the millennium in chapter 20. After all, the term appears 6 times in as many verses. Verse 2, verse 3, verse 4, verse 5, verse 6, verse 7. Over and over again, this period of 1,000 years, the millennium, is mentioned. It's hard to say that there is no millennium. Well, that's not exactly what amillennialists would say. They would argue that there is no millennium in the sense that either the premillennials or the postmillennials would see it as a time in which For the premillennials, Christ is reigning upon the earth, and the church wins in the world, as it were. Or for the postmillennials, Christ isn't reigning in the earth, but nevertheless, Christianity makes great progress and peace and prosperity in the nations. So this very positive view of the 1,000 years in which everything is rosy. Amillennialists would say, well, no, that's not what these 1,000 years are going to be like. So then, we have to grapple with this text and seek to understand which, if any of these views, may be right. We need to understand the text itself. What is this passage saying to us? And we're going to take 3 weeks to get through these 10 verses, the first 10 verses of chapter 20, so that we can do it some justice. The first thing, then, that we need to look at is these first 3 verses, where we are introduced to an angel coming down from heaven, holding in his hand the key to the bottomless pit and a great chain. And he seized the dragon, that ancient serpent who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years, and threw him into the pit, and shut it, and sealed it over him, so that he might not deceive the nations any longer until 1,000 years were ended. After that, he must be released for a little while. So these 3 verses are taking our focus this morning. And the first thing that I want you to notice in these 3 verses is that Satan is bound for a specific time. That's the time of 1,000 years that is so dominates this section of Revelation. Satan is bound for a specific period of time, 1,000 years. Now that in itself tells us something, because over the last 54 messages we have seen over and over and over again that numbers count. Numbers signify something. Numbers mean something. They are not simply to be taken literally as they stand. Oh, 1,000 years. 1,000 years. No, it's the number itself is telling us something. Now, what could it possibly be telling us? Just take the number by itself and think about other numbers that we've already encountered and have been able to interpret. Well, one of the numbers that appears regularly through Revelation is the number 7. But number 7 doesn't really relate to 1,000, unless you do some mathematical gymnastics. It's going to be something simpler than that. All of the numbers are actually quite simple in the book of Revelation. It doesn't take a mathematical genius to work it out. Another number that is very common in the book of Revelation is the number 10. And immediately we think, what, 10 and 1,000? There's some relationship there, isn't there? What is the relationship? Well, 1,000 is the cube of 10. 10 times 10 times 10. And the number 10, we have observed, indicates fullness or completeness. And the cubing of something emphasizes that completeness. We'll discover it later on when we look at the New Jerusalem that comes down out of heaven and discover that it's a perfect cube. And there are some numbers associated with that as well. But cast your minds back to a passage that we already had seen in chapter 7, where we have a number of people who are sealed as the servants of God, verse 3. And in verse 4, John says, I heard the number of the sealed, 144,000 sealed from every tribe of the sons of Israel. And 144,000 are demonstrated to be 12,000 from each of the 12 tribes. But what we also noted when we considered that passage was that these tribes are not the physical tribes that we would expect to see here, nor are they arranged in a way that we would normally expect to see the 12 tribes of Israel listed. And we noted that in these tribes there is a symbol of the people of God, both under the Old Covenant and the New Covenant, the people of God in every age. Again, it has relationships with the New Jerusalem in chapter 21. The point for us to note right now, though, is that that 144,000 is 12 times 12 times 10 times 10 times 10. It is the idea of all of God's people in all of time, absolutely every one of them, with no one missing. Absolute completeness. That's the idea there. And that's the idea here in naming these 1,000 years. It is the idea of fullness, of completeness of time. The 1,000 years, the millennium, only appears in this chapter in the book of Revelation. It only appears in this chapter in the whole of the New Testament. It only appears in this chapter in the whole of the Bible. This idea of the millennium. Nevertheless, there is nothing new in this millennia. The only new thing about it is the number that is being used to symbolize something. The thing that is symbolized we have seen before. It's important to remember, you see, that the book of Revelation never gives us anything new. Sometimes a new picture, perhaps, but the substance is never something that is revealed for the very first time here. The book of Revelation is really the uncovering of what God has already revealed before. It's a revealing of things that God has already declared. And so it shouldn't surprise us that when we read of this 1,000 years, that there are references to this period of time in other parts of Revelation, and indeed in other parts of the scriptures, even though the term millennium or 1,000 years is not itself used elsewhere. Let's begin with the book of Revelation itself. This passage in chapter 20 has its parallels earlier in the book. And one of those parallels is to be found in the 12th chapter. The reason why we know, for one reason at least, why we know that it's a parallel, is because the similarity of the language that is used. Chapter 20 in verse 2, we're told that the angel seized the dragon, that ancient serpent who is the devil and Satan. In chapter 12 and verse 9, we read that the great dragon was thrown down, that ancient serpent who is called the devil and Satan. Now, the use of that language by John indicates a connection. Mustn't lose sight of that. When John uses similar phrases, similar ideas in one part, it has a link back to its previous use somewhere else. And this is the case in this 20th chapter. So we have it in chapter 12. And what do we find earlier in chapter 12? Well, in verse 7 we're told, a war arose in heaven, Michael and his angels fighting against the dragon. And the dragon and his angels fought back, But he was defeated, and there was no longer any place for them in heaven. And the great dragon was thrown down, that ancient serpent who is called the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world. He was thrown down to the earth, and his angels were thrown down with him. He's thrown down. Or he is cast down. And this is the language that we find in chapter 20. The angel seized the dragon, the ancient serpent, who is the devil and Satan, bound him for 1,000 years, and threw him, cast him into the pit, and shut it and sealed it over him, so that he might not deceive the nations any longer until 1,000 years were ended. Now in chapter 12, the dragon is cast out of heaven upon the earth. In chapter 12, he seeks to attack the woman who was to give birth, or had given birth, to the male child, who is Jesus. And having failed to do that, he proceeds to attack her other offspring, who we saw was the Church of Jesus Christ. And this goes on for a period of a time, times, and half a time. Chapter 12, verse 14, which, if you may remember, signifies 3.5 years. A time, 1 year, times, 2 years, and half a time. 3.5 years, which equates to 1,260 days, which we find there in verse 6. The woman fled into the wilderness, where she has a place prepared by God, in which she is to be nourished for 1,260 days. It would seem, just as a provisional interpretation, which we'll need to explore further, that it would seem at first glance that there's a connection between 1,000 years and this period of 1,260 days, or a time, times, and half a time. But let's explore this a little bit further. We've noticed that Satan being sealed in this pit, in verse 3 of chapter 20, is the equivalent of what Michael did to Satan in chapter 12, casting Satan out of heaven. Now let's look elsewhere in the New Testament, because Jesus has some important words to say about this incident. We'll look first at Luke's Gospel, where in chapter 10 and in verses 17 and 18, having sent out 72 of his disciples into the villages and towns of Galilee to preach and to heal, these 72 return, we're told, with joy, saying, "Lord, even the demons are subject to us in your name." And he said to them, "I saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven." And in John's Gospel, chapter 12, Jesus says in verse 31, speaking concerning his death that is to come shortly, he says, "Now is the judgment of this world. Now will the ruler of this world be cast out." What Jesus indicates is that through his first coming, the entirety of it seen as a unit, his first coming to save, his birth, his ministry, his death, his resurrection, his ascension, through this act, Satan is conquered. We've already seen that before. I refer you back to our studies in chapter 12 in particular. if you want to refresh yourself, listen to that message. Satan is conquered. Satan is cast down at that point. And that's what John sees in chapter 20. An angel coming, holding in his hand the key to the bottomless pit and a great chain. He seizes the dragon, that ancient serpent who is the devil and Satan, and binds him for 1,000 years and throws him into the pit and shuts it and seals it. So there's the beginning of 1,000 years. With the first coming of Jesus Christ. When does the period end? Well, in order to understand that better, we need to consider our second point. The first point was this, that Satan is bound for a specific time. Now, we're sort of moving aside from that point, we're going to come back to it, to find out when that specific time ends. But in order to find that out, we need to move on to our next point, which is that he is bound for a specific purpose. A specific time and a specific purpose. The text itself, our passage, tells us what that purpose is. The angel threw him into the pit, shut it, sealed it over him, so that he might not deceive the nations any longer, until 1,000 years were ended. So the purpose is to limit Satan's deception. What we need to recognize, though, is that this limitation is not absolute. Remember that the language is pictorial. The language is symbolic. There is no actual pit that Satan is thrown into. Satan is a spiritual rather than a physical being. There is no key that somehow turns in a lock to lock this pit. Not in actuality. There is no seal that is set upon it so that this door over this pit is locked and sealed and cannot be opened. This is all symbolic of a restriction that is placed on Satan. Okay, it isn't that Satan is banished from the earth. The question is, in what sense is he restricted? I've already indicated that I don't believe that he is restricted absolutely. He is not limited absolutely in every way, banished from the earth, having no influence in the earth at all. Such a view would contradict all of the rest of the book of Revelation. And the rest of the Bible. Well, we know that Satan is prowling around like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. Where he seeks to keep the nations in darkness. We know that Satan is active. The book of Revelation has told us over and over and over again that Satan is active in this world. And that he is even active seeking to deceive. And yet here we're told that he is cast down into this pit in order that he might not deceive the nations any longer. So are we wrong with our first understanding of the beginning of this period of 1,000 years? Well, I think the texts that we've referred to speak clearly enough. The casting of Satan down from heaven, the casting of Satan into the pit are one and the same. But Satan is limited, but his limitation is not absolute in every area. So then, in what way is he limited? And I think that the answer to that is twofold. Firstly, Satan will not be able to keep the nations in darkness. He will not be able to maintain his hold upon the nations, deceiving them so that they do not recognize the light. His work of deception began in the Garden of Eden. Eve declares to God, "The serpent deceived me." And throughout the Old Testament, you see the power of Satan to deceive. The vast majority of the population of the world in every age during the Old Testament era was shrouded in darkness, spiritual darkness, brought about by the work of Satan. Even among the people of God, that was true. When I say people of God, I mean the nation of Israel. You think about it, from the moment that Israel are formulated as a nation following the Exodus from Egypt, there is nothing but grumbling and complaining and rebellion in the hearts of those people. Even after they enter into the promised land following 40 years of wandering in the wilderness, they very quickly begin to worship the idols of the land that they now inhabit. It ends up with 10 tribes being completely scattered and destroyed, and 2 other tribes being exiled in captivity in Babylon. Such was Satan's success in deceiving them. In Matthew's Gospel, we read in chapter 4, in verse 12. Now, when Jesus heard that John had been arrested, he withdrew into Galilee. And leaving Nazareth, he went and lived in Capernaum by the sea, in the territory of Zebulun and Naphtali, so that what was spoken by the prophet Isaiah might be fulfilled. The land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, the way of the sea, beyond the Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles, the people dwelling in darkness have seen a great light. And for those dwelling in the region and shadow of death, on them the light has dawned. From that time Jesus began to preach, saying, "Repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand." The light came into the world. The light shone in the midst of the darkness of this world when Jesus came. And it was a light that was to extend beyond the region of Galilee, beyond the nation of Israel, to all the nations of the earth. As we discover in Acts chapter 14, where in verses 15 and to 17 we read, "Men, why are you doing these things? We also are men of like nature with you, and we bring you good news that you should turn from these vain things to a living God, who made the heaven and the earth and the sea and all that is in them. In past generations, he allowed all the nations to walk in their own ways. Yet he did not leave himself without witness." And in Acts chapter 17, verses 30 and 31, Paul again says, "The times of ignorance God overlooked, But now he commands all people everywhere to repent, because he has fixed a day on which he will judge the world in righteousness by a man whom he has appointed, and of this he has given assurance to all by raising him from the dead. God allowed the nations to go their own way. God allowed the nations to continue in ignorance, in darkness. Satan was at work. But then things changed with the coming of Jesus Christ. And with the coming of Jesus Christ, light shines. Light shines in a way that it has never shone before. And the light penetrates the darkness. The darkness of hearts that had been hardened, of eyes that had been blinded by Satan. And Satan's influence then in the world is seen to collapse to a large degree in one particular area that he is now no longer able to keep people in ignorance of the truth of the gospel. And this is what we saw was happening in chapter 11 of Revelation. This is another one of those parallel passages that is connected to chapter 20. In Revelation chapter 11, John is given a measuring rod. And he is told to rise and measure the temple of God and the altar and those who worship there. But do not measure the court outside the temple. Leave that out, for it is given over to the nations, and they will trample the holy city for 42 months. And I will grant authority to my witnesses, and they will prophesy for 1,260 days, clothed in sackcloth. These are the two olive trees and the two lampstands that stand before the Lord of the earth. And if anyone would harm them, fire pours from their mouth and consumes their foes. If anyone would harm them, this is how he is doomed to be killed. They have the power to shut the sky, that no rain may fall during the days of their prophesying. And they have power over the waters to turn them into blood and to strike the earth with every kind of plague so often as they desire. Now here we have two witnesses who are working in the world. And if anyone seeks to oppose their witness, they find themselves on the receiving end of judgment. So that the witness of these two individuals continues. It is not stamped out. It is not covered up. Yes, there is persecution. Yes, they are opposed, but the opposition is unsuccessful for 1,260 days. The period of opposition, 42 months, is exactly the same period as the period of witness, which is exactly the same period as the 1,000 years. You see, the time has come for the gospel to penetrate the world. And Satan is prevented from intercepting it, from thwarting it, from hindering it, from accomplishing God's goal in the world of seeking out and saving everyone whom he has chosen to give to his Son. It is, Satan is bound for a specific purpose, that the gospel may have free course and be glorified in the world, that it would accomplish without hindrance from Satan that which God desires. Now, this interpretation is confirmed over and over again in the New Testament. in Matthew's Gospel, in chapter 12. Jesus says, when he's been accused of casting out demons in the name of a demon, in the name of Beelzebub, Jesus responds that what he is actually doing is this: how can someone enter a strong man's house and plunder his goods unless he first binds the strong man? Then indeed he may plunder his goods. Jesus is working in this world having bound the strong man. And he's plundering the strong man's goods. This is the picture of evangelism in this world. Satan is bound, and the witnesses of God are successful in retrieving from Satan those whom he has deceived and bringing them into the light of the gospel. In Luke's Gospel, chapter 10, we've already looked at these verses 17 and 18. When we were considering that Satan is bound for a specific time. Now, in terms of him being bound for a specific purpose, we need to note that these 72 who return with joy were sent out by Jesus to preach. They were sent out by Jesus to proclaim the same message that Jesus himself had been proclaiming. And they return and they say, even the demons are subject to us in your name. And he said, I saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven. You see, the binding of Satan, the casting down of Satan into the pit, is connected with the work of evangelism. He is bound in regard to evangelism, to the gospel witness. Chapter 10, verses 17 and 18, with these 72 being sent out, is really a foretaste of the book of Acts, where the church disperses through the world and takes the gospel with it. Then in John's Gospel, in chapter 12 and in verse 32, having said, now is the judgment of this world, now will the ruler of this world be cast out, which we observed earlier, Jesus went on and he said, and I, when I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all people to myself. He's speaking there of his death, resurrection and ascension into heaven. And the work of the gospel will go on and will be successful. This is the work of witness in the world that Satan is unable to oppose. So that's the first way in which Satan's binding is effective. He is unable to prevent the spread of the gospel in the world. But we have to recognize that in chapter 20, there is an even more specific way that this binding is to be applied. He threw him into the pit, shut it and sealed it over him so that he might not deceive the nations any longer. There's the idea of evangelism, gospel witness no longer being hindered in the way it was before Jesus Christ came, when the vast majority of the human population lived and died in ignorance of the gospel. Even those who had been set up as a nation to be a light among the Gentiles failed because of Satan's deceptive influence, stealing their hearts to worship idols. Now there's all of that. No longer will he be able to deceive the nations. But you see, there is a focus on the future. Until the 1,000 years were ended. After that, he must be released for a little while. Now we need to skip ahead a little bit here. Because the 1,000 years ended, see Satan deceiving the nations for a specific purpose. Look at it in verse 7. When the 1,000 years are ended, Satan will be released from his prison and will come out to deceive the nations that are at the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them for battle. Their number is like the sand of the sea. And they marched up over the broad plain of the earth and surrounded the camp of the saints and the beloved city. In the past, Satan has sought to deceive the world so that they would not believe the message of God. In the future, Satan will seek to deceive the nations of the world in order to bring them to battle against God and his people. There will be no longer any point trying to deceive the nations against the gospel, because the gospel will no longer be being preached. You see, this 1,000 years, equivalent to the 1,260 days, lasts for the period in which gospel witness will take place. When gospel witness finishes, because everyone whom God has chosen to save has been saved, Satan will then be released. There's no one else to deceive against the gospel. And his deception then turns to bringing all the peoples of the world together in this last climactic battle against God and the church. A battle that we've seen repeated in other visions that John has seen, and is repeated here again in chapter 20 from a different angle that we will look at in closer detail later on. But you'll have noticed connections already. The fact that Gog and Magog is mentioned. And we saw that chapter 19, speaking about the gathering of the birds to the great supper of God to eat the flesh of the people who remain on the earth, draws on the language from Ezekiel chapters 38 and 39, where similar language is used. And so we see the interconnectedness of these that focus upon the end of time. And so this gives us the answer to our question, doesn't it? Satan is bound for a specific purpose, to deceive the nations. Deceive them initially from the gospel, deceive them in the end into attacking an enemy that they have no possibility of ever beating. He is bound for a specific time, a time that begins with the first coming of Jesus Christ and that ends shortly before his second coming, when gospel witness is completed and everything is set for the last battle. The purpose of the binding then indicates the time which began with Christ's birth and ends just before his second coming. Not a literal 1,000 years. Not 1,000 years in which for Christians there will be peace and prosperity and calm, either under Jesus' physical reign on earth or under a reign from heaven whereby the church makes great advances and sees society transformed by the gospel. But 1,000 years in which the gospel draws in sinners to faith in Jesus Christ, despite opposition from the evil one. He is bound for a specific purpose, not bound absolutely from any influence in this world. We've seen it. We cannot deny it. Throughout the period, Satan is an enemy of the church, and he seeks to destroy the church. But the witness of the church continues. The witness of the church accomplishes God's purpose. Everyone who has the mark, the seal of Jesus Christ, will be brought into the kingdom of Christ. And everyone else will be destroyed with the beast and the dragon. Now we need to conclude with recognizing that this is not just theory. This is where we are. We are in the midst of this millennium, this 1,000 years. And we are to be working for God. We have a work to do. Revelation is written to 7 churches who are lampstands. They are to hold up the light of the gospel so that it shines into the world. So that those whom God is calling see the light and are drawn to the light and embrace the light of Jesus Christ. We have a work to do to make the light shine in the darkness of this world. We have a work to do to make Christ known. And our lives are to be lived for Christ as his witnesses. Whatever happens to us, will we be persecuted? Yes, absolutely, we will be persecuted. Will we be destroyed? Absolutely not. And we'll see the reality of that next week.